Hi there, I'm Tom Schultz, host of Voices of Montana, an issue-oriented newsmaker radio program. It's heard weekdays on 19 radio stations with 28 signals all across our great treasure state. Thank you for clicking on the podcast. Please subscribe, and we'll do our best to keep you connected. We're also on Facebook and on the web at voicesofmontana.com, where I'd love to hear from you. Please contact me at tom@voicesofmontana.com. Good show. We always learn things when the professor, Rob Nadelson's back on the program here, original show host. We'll pick up, of course, this tariff ruling. There was some things, as I was talking about, Rob was cited again by Justice Clarence Thomas in his dissension of the majority's ruling on tariff use by the president. Rob Nadelson says he thinks they got it right, but for the wrong reason, right? There's a lot to talk about here, too, in the Montana Constitution. We have an opportunity. 2030 is the next time we can vote on a constitution. We'll talk about that as there's movement along in that regard. Rob Nadelson today on Voices of Montana. Again, thanks for making us part of your morning and afternoon, or sometimes it's in the evening, making us part of your Montana day. It's for 2 decades strong and working on 3 from Montana for Montana, Voices of Montana. We're just going to open it up right now. There's no sense waiting. Rob Nadelson is on the line. Of course, as I mentioned, professor, University of Montana for a lot of years. Not the only school that he taught constitutional law at, but certainly the one where he had a lot of years there as well. Did practice private private practice as well. And just a lot here to talk about as we look back at the years that he has studied constitutional law and the number of times he's been cited. It's not just the Supreme Court for the 41st time, by the way. It's like 18 other high states, high courts as well. Curious about all of that, too. And then there's some thought-provoking questions about our Montana Constitution as there's an opportunity to maybe write some things there if people see some wrongs. Rob Nadelson. Good morning, Rob. How you doing, sir?
Good morning. It's great to be with you. It's great to be with your audience. By the way, your reference to me as the professor reminds me, Tom, in 1996, when I was taking on Mark Roscoe in the Republican primary, he always used to refer to me as the professor. Right? The professor speaking from his perch with no experience. The ironic thing was that I had more real-world experience than he did. But I had to be, Tom, in that race, I had to be super polite. I couldn't denigrate him. I always referred to him respectfully as governor, but he would refer to me as the professor, as if I were just some woolly-headed guy who didn't know what I was talking about. So in it was annoying at the time, which he intended it to be, but it was also fun in retrospect.
Yeah, it's very endearing to me because I remember I was like Cody Ross to Rob Nadelson many, many years ago as well, and learned an awful lot about conservative politics in that position as well, helping you host this program years ago. But it was always endearing to me to call you the professor because, of course, we have a lot.
Well, thank you.
Yeah.
And of course, my message in that primary was that Mark Roscoe really wasn't a Republican. And now everybody, including Mark Roscoe, recognizes that. But it's about 30 years too late.
Well, identity for the conservatives has been an issue over a lot of years, and it seems to be shifting in a lot of ways. And that's why, I suppose, that we have in our Constitution the ability to rewrite it, because we do find ourselves in different cultural times. You recently had an event in Helena, well attended. There was protests outside. Maybe it's been a while since you were the bulk of that or the point of that protest, so to speak. Talk about that, Rob.
Oh, it was great. In addition to being a senior fellow at the Independence Institute in Colorado, I'm also a senior fellow at the Mountain States Policy Center, and I concentrate on Montana legal issues. And so Mountain States decided to have a dinner in Helena in which they invited the governor to talk about his legislative agenda, and they also invited me to talk about the idea that in 2030, Montanans can decide whether or not they want a new constitutional convention and what are some problems in the current constitution that might induce Montanans to say yes to that. Well, somebody on the left got this all screwed up and thought that it was Governor Gianforte who was pushing the idea of new constitutional convention. And Governor Gianforte is kind of a red flag in front of these people, so they decided there was going to be a demonstration. So they were out there saying, Gianforte, no constitutional convention, hands off our constitution. And he had nothing to do with it at all. So I decided I was going to go out and engage with these people. And there was a there were some newspaper reports about this. So I went out to the this was being held at the Colonial Inn in Helena, and they were out by the street. So I went and I walked to them, and I said, they were making a lot of noise. And I said, look, guys, it's got nothing to do with the governor. You want to blame somebody, blame me, or blame Mountain State. The governor's got nothing to do. Oh, really? Yeah. And then I was when I was walking back to the hotel where the event was, one of the guys says, can I walk with you? He says, I don't know anything about this. He was one of the demonstrators, but he didn't know anything about it. All he knew was that he was against the governor. And so I explained to him that every 20 years, Montanans get this opportunity to vote on whether they want a new constitutional convention. They decided no overwhelmingly back in 1990, but the vote was much closer in 2010 because there are problems with the Montana Constitution. And all the convention could do anyway is get together and recommend changes, and the voters would get to vote on them. So he was totally uninformed about this thing that brought him out to the demonstration. It was clear to me, Tom, that these people were paid. Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't know if they're all paid, but a lot of these demonstrations that just crop up, you know, somebody's got some nonprofit's got money and they give it to people to go out and demonstrate because they had no clue as to what they were demonstrating against.
Well, and it's up to the media to make note of that as well, because these are not generic. They're paid for, so there's an agenda behind it. And if you're going to cover one side, cover the other side more fully, right?
There's a symbiotic relationship of mutual assistance between the left and the mainstream media. The left provides events for the mainstream media to cover, and the mainstream media in turn covers them and covers for them. So you never actually see the mainstream media saying, you know, we had our reporter investigating, it turns out these people were all paid. They never do that. If there's violence, they say, well, most of the demonstrators were peaceful. Well, they were also peaceful on January 6th, right? Most of them, but that didn't prevent it from being a riot. And so I think it has to be understood that way. They help each other. But there's an interesting comparison with the Tea Party. Remember, the Tea Party was having demonstrations all over the country, and they were entirely peaceful, but they were noisy and demonstrative.
Yeah.
And the coverage of them was very negative by the media.
It's frustrating. So, we know that's kind of like the playing field. It's not exactly level in that regard. So
no, it's not. It's not. You're playing, it's like a pool. It's like I compare it to a football field, you know, where the football field's been slanted and one side has to run uphill, the other side gets to run downhill, and the favored side gets to start on the opponent's 20-yard line, where the disfavored side has to start on its own one, and it only gets two downs, you know. And that's sort of the game. When I ran for governor the second time, my consultant told me that the general rule of thumb is that media coverage is worth about 11 points, 11 percentage points to a Democratic candidate.
Wow.
In other words, because the media are biased, generally speaking, in favor of the Democrats, they kind of start with like the equivalent of 11 points up. I don't know if those figures are still accurate today, but this was in 2000, and that's what he told me then.
Yeah, it seems that way, too. And you know, I think that makes your job a lot tougher, not necessarily your job. I think you're trying to raise awareness here as well. But those who are supporting at least a look at an evaluation of our Constitution, because this is not low-hanging fruit. This is stuff you have to dig in, understand, you know, the value of it, the importance of it, and not a lot of people are, you know, directly connected to this. So how do you move the ball here? How does the average person understand the opportunity that this brings, maybe the challenges that this brings as well, in order to do something here in 2030?
Well, of course, at our point at this stage, it's just an education campaign.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure there'll be people out there actively campaigning with radio ads or whatever. But this is just to let Montanans know, number one, that they've got this opportunity coming up. And that number two, there are some real problems with the current Constitution. Now, I'm not not one of them who believes, as some people seem to believe, that the 1972 state constitution is, you know, the devil's handiwork. It's not all bad.
Right.
But there are some serious defects. And one of the indications of those defects is the fact that so many policy decisions are being made by the courts. Educational decisions are being made by the courts rather than the legislature or the people. What matters can get on the ballot, that decision is made by the courts. Environmental decisions, policy decisions in which people can legitimately disagree are being made by the courts. This is largely the reflection of problems in the Constitution that don't provide clear enough guidance, don't provide clear rules. What, you know, the people who drafted the 1972 Constitution were very well-meaning. They really wanted to do the right thing. But none of them had ever had any experience drafting the Constitution. It wasn't like, you know, the famous Philadelphia Convention in 1787, where most of the delegates had a great deal of government experience and they drafted state constitution. It wasn't like that at all. I mean, these people really didn't really know. And my own study of the era convinces me that that the staff and others controlled the information flow, so that not only were there a lot of things they didn't know, there were also a lot of things they couldn't learn. So the result was that they used words and phrases that didn't have legal meanings. Mm. They have contradictions in different sections of the Constitution, lack of clarity throughout the document. Again, it's not all bad, and I don't want to exaggerate it, but it's more than could be handled by, say, a single amendment.
You know, and we know of the Clean and Healthful Environment Clause. I think that the courts are activists in this regard, because I'm not sure it makes good jurisprudence to initiate rulings that, I mean, DNRC cannot evaluate the cosmos for every gravel pit that they're trying to permit.
No, they can't. I mean, we're judges. Judges are lawyers with robes. They graduated from law school. They have no expertise in environmental matters. And by the way, when the Constitution was being explained to the voters, one of the points that was made over and over again is this is not something the courts are going to determine. This is going to be up to the legislature to implement the environmental rights, that the legislatures are going to decide to their extent and how they can be applied, and if the people don't like it, they can defeat the legislators at the next election. It was never supposed to be a court thing. I have a book written years after the Constitution in which it still says it's supposed to be a legislative matter, the environmental rights are. It wasn't really until 1999 that the Montana Supreme Court seized full control over environmental policy in the state of Montana. But they did so in part because the language of the Constitution was not sufficiently clear.
Well, you want to know the original meaning of the U.S. Constitution, look up Rob Nadelson. He's got a new blog site out there as well. A lot of good articles. I kind of want to talk about them here, too. A number of things. One of them will be about this tariff ruling from the U.S. Supreme Court. So we'll get on that here in just a little bit. It is NadelsonRob.com. And then you can go and pick out the article you like to read, you know, /blog. But NadelsonRob.com for more information there. And Rob, I've been going through that. I've always appreciated your writings and your ability to explain this to us here. The 72 Constitution in Montana, it did barely squeak by. There was like 230, and this is one of the things, it was run in June. It was not run during a general election where you have 327,000 people turn out. It was run where you only have 237,000 people run out. Just barely, you know, not long after the draft was approved, and it passed by 2,300 votes. I mean, that's significant. Let's go back. Why, when you look at this Constitution, what do you think needs to be righted with it?
Before I answer that, Tom, let me say it's not clear the Constitution passed. I did a study for this.
Yes.
To this day, it's the first peer-reviewed scholarly article on the ratification of the Montana Constitution. It came out in 2018, and there's a link available on my website. The returns showed that there were just barely more yes votes than no votes. But the existing rule was that you, in order to have a new constitution, you required something a little bit more than just more yes and no votes. You had to have yes votes that amounted to a majority of all the people who came to the polls and voted on any issue. So, and this was explained to the voters again and again and again. If you come and you want to vote for the Constitution, you've got to vote for the Constitution. Because if you vote against it, that's a vote against it. But also if you abstain, that's a vote against it. And when the returns came in, the Constitution had fewer votes than were required by the applicable election law. And that triggered one of the most momentous lawsuits ever decided in any state court, a case called Cashmore versus Anderson, in which the Montana Supreme Court took trial jurisdiction. They didn't send it to a trial court. They took original jurisdiction or trial jurisdiction themselves, decided the case themselves. There were five justices on the court. Three of them initially in chambers voted against the Constitution. They ruled that the Constitution did not get enough votes. Later on, one of the justices, for reasons that remain uncertain, switched his vote, and the new Constitution was approved by 3-2. And there have been a lot of allegations of corruption. I'm not going to go there. But the point is that this was a really narrow squeaker. One reason for a new Constitution is simply what the scholars call legitimacy, the idea that it should be something which is accepted and clearly accepted in an open, transparent election where nobody has any doubts about whether it passed or didn't pass. So that's one of the reasons, actually, for having a new constitution, or at least a revised one, and then submitting the product to the people again.
Yeah, and that discrepancy is significant. Out of 237,000 votes cast, 7,300 did not vote specifically for the passage there. So,
right, they voted on other issues that were on the ballot, and they had been told if you abstain, it's a vote against.
Yes.
That was said over, and again, I go into this in the article, over and over and over again explained by the press and by the Constitution's advocates. Please vote yes, don't abstain, because abstain is a no vote.
All right, Skip has go ahead, finish up.
Well, I was just going to give you another example for people who live in western Montana and may remember this. It's 25 years ago, but the famous episodes involving the Hells Angels and the little riot that occurred in Missoula. Missoula, in anticipation of a Hell's Angels visit during the summer, had brought in police from out of state. And they did this in good faith, but there's a provision in the Constitution which says you're not supposed to bring in people from out of state to do police work. And after the Hell's Angels didn't cause any problems, but the out-of-state police got into a big argument with a riot with some of the people in Missoula. Anyway, and I know you remember this time.
I do.
Anyway, the question came up, does this provision of the Constitution that prohibits police from being brought in from out of state, does that just apply to private people, like private companies, or does it apply to government? When you read the Constitution, it's not clear. And there was a big argument over this. I ultimately decided, it does apply to government. The city of Missoula inadvertently violated the Constitution. But you have to really dig to come to that conclusion. And to this day, we still don't know if it applies to private individuals or private companies. So that's an example of a provision that's in the Bill of Rights that is unclear and needs to be clarified, and a convention's a way to do that.
Rob Nadelson with us again. He is a senior fellow of constitutional jurisprudence, the Independent Institute, as well as Mountain States Policy Center. That's mountainstatespolicy.org. Also, as I noted, nadelsonrob.com for more on his writings here as well. Let's take this call here as it pertains to this constitutional convention. Skip, listening in Hamilton on KLYQ. Good morning, Skip. You're on with Rob.
Hi, Skip. Good morning, Tom. And good morning, Rob. It's wonderful that you come on and help us with all these things. I hope when you're in the state this year, you're able to do some hiking, sir. And what I was going to ask you about was in the Montana State Constitution, when we have this opportunity in front of us to get it together, to have a constitutional convention, I've been a student of this for a long time, and other people have that are just private citizens, in not in any elected offices, and maybe in some appointed offices in counties, for instance, but not been able to be part of something that they care so much about. How does one get into the process of becoming a delegate for a constitutional convention? What an amazing thing to, like Maynann Ellison was in 71 and 72, and she from Ravalli County, and she ended up writing the preamble, and as an example. So can you give us some cliff notes on what does somebody do if they want to participate in this wonderful possible event?
Thanks, Skip. I'm going to broaden that a little bit. Again, we're jumping ahead, but if the state does decide to rewrite its constitution or look at it, what's that process?
Yeah, well, essentially, it goes on the ballot automatically in 2030 as to whether or not the voters want to call a convention. If the answer is yes, then the legislature must pass a law called an Enabling Act. And the Enabling Act will set forth the rules by which delegates are elected. In 1772, there were 100 delegates, basically one from each congressional district, one from each House district, and I suspect the legislature will probably do that again, and it will probably provide for some procedure like petitioning to be on the ballot or perhaps for a party nomination. The Montana Supreme Court decided before the last convention that officers, including legislators, are not eligible to be delegates. I'm not sure that was the right decision, but I think we have to, that's the rule as of now. So if you're running, presumably you have to hold no other office. And whether it's going to be partisan or nonpartisan, that's going to be up to the legislature to decide. And then once the delegates are elected, the legislature may appoint a day for initial meeting, but from there on out, as in the case of most conventions, the timing and so forth is up to the convention itself. They then meet, they organize themselves, and then they proceed to adopt rules. And in the past, what happened, and I made an allusion to this, is there were state agencies set up to assist the delegates and provide them with information, and that information, as I alluded to in a few minutes ago, was biased. Did not give the delegates the full scope of what they needed to know. But today we have the internet, and so I don't think that's going to be a big problem.
I've got 1 minute left. What's to keep this from getting, turning into a runaway convention, as they like to say?
The Montana Supreme Court already has addressed that. It says that the role of a state constitutional convention is to propose a constitution to the people, period. That's all the power it has. When the 72 convention tried to exercise additional power, they were slapped down by the court. And this is true, by the way, of conventions generally, including constitutional conventions. They are restricted by the scope of the call that brought them into existence, the law that brings them into existence. So it's true of lesser conventions, like, say, an Article 5 convention for writing an amendment to the U.S. Constitution, but it's also true even of constitutional conventions, that they are limited by the law, and the Montana Supreme Court has shown a willingness to enforce that law.
Rob Nadelson is with us. We like to say the professor, a former University of Montana law professor, a past Montana gubernatorial candidate. We're going to pick up here shortly as the U.S. Supreme Court has ruled President Trump, or a president, cannot use the International Emergency Economic Powers Act to impose tariffs. Rob Nadelson's work was cited in a dissent by Justice Thomas in that ruling. I think, Rob, you think we're kind of launching right into it here just because we're chatting. Good to chat with you. We've got a lot of things to catch up on. But you think the Supreme Court got it right, but not necessarily for the right reason?
Yeah, that's my position. Now, it's kind of ironic that Justice Thomas would have cited me in an opinion where he disagrees with my conclusion. But that sometimes happens. About 10 years ago, I was cited by Chief Justice John Roberts, and he was dissenting in an opinion in which I actually agreed with the majority, although I didn't disagree with the precise point he was making. To put it in a nutshell, my view is that President Trump interpreted the law correctly, that the law purported to give him authority to do what he did. But I believe the law is unconstitutional. The International Emergency Economic Powers Act. The law purports to grant to the president power to regulate, I'm quoting here, to regulate importation. In other words, to regulate commerce with foreign countries. The foreign commerce power is a power that is given to Congress, not to the president. And so while the Congress can delegate certain powers to the president, I don't think you can delegate it virtually its entire power to regulate importation, and that's what this statute purported to do. There was one other interesting issue for us constitutional wonks that came up here, and the question was, were these tariffs taxes or were they regulations of commerce?
Yeah.
Because a tariff can raise money, it can be a tax, and it can also regulate commerce. And in this case, President Trump's tariffs both raised money and regulated commerce. The answer to the constitutional question comes from the founding era. And the founding era, Americans said in the founding era, that if you've got a tariff like President Trump imposed, which both raises money and regulates commerce, it is to be treated as a regulation of commerce under the Commerce Clause. The court did not get that right. They kind of alluded to it, but they treated the tariff mostly as a tax. So, again, my result would have been that the law was unconstitutional, the president relied upon it in good faith, but the tariffs fall with the law. The court's position was that they upheld the law, and they blamed the president for misinterpreting it. I will say, finally, to wrap this up, this is typical of the Roberts Court. The Roberts Court is often described as, quote, conservative, but one thing the Roberts Court does not do, apparently, is to overturn federal laws, unless there's a Bill of Rights violation. I have not yet seen a decision which has come out of the Roberts Court where they've said the federal government has simply exceeded the list of powers that the Congress gives it, that they're not willing to take on Congress for whatever reason.
Boy, and that Obamacare decision years ago.
That's another example. Yeah. And there were two other Obamacare cases where they could have struck down the law, but they do everything they possibly can to try to uphold the validity of a congressional law. Interestingly enough, the court under William Rehnquist, Chief Justice Rehnquist, back in the 90s, they were willing to take on Congress. They didn't strike down a lot of laws, but they did it sometimes. But the Roberts Court, they're willing to curtail administrative agencies, but they're not willing to face down Congress. And that's unfortunate because we have a runaway Congress.
Yeah, and I don't think it gave us clarity as to what a tax really is.
The court got it wrong in the Obamacare case too. That mandate, it was a mandate. You have to buy insurance, and if you don't buy it, we're going to assess you a penalty. That penalty was not a tax; it was a regulation of the economy, and in my view, an unconstitutional one. But they said it's a tax if they're. And Chief Justice Roberts is very open about this. His philosophy, which is a philosophy in fairness that dates back many years, is that if there's any way to uphold the constitutionality of a federal law, we'll try to do that. But they don't grant the same deference to state laws, interestingly enough.
Hmm. And you've done a lot of work. I mean, as I looked at some of the citations, again, 41st time for the Supreme Court, but, I mean, Alabama, Alaska, California, Tennessee, Montana, of course, they have cited your work as well. Where do they need the clarity? I mean, I know there's a lot of vague language in there, right? And that allows judicial activism. What are they usually looking for or need help with?
And All right. Let's draw a distinction here between the Montana Constitution and the U.S. Constitution. A lot of people will tell you who write in this area that the U.S. Constitution is full of vague and ambiguous terms. If somebody tells you that, he's ignorant.
Yeah.
Okay? The U.S. Constitution is actually a reasonably precise document. There are a few provisions in there which are deliberately vague, like should the public safety require it. But mostly the provisions that were put into the U.S. Constitution were provisions that had clear meanings in law or clear meanings in established usage, like the freedom of speech, the freedom of press. They knew what they meant, except, you know, there might be disputes around the edges, but they basically knew what they meant. The problem with the Montana Constitution, by contrast, is that they used words that did not have that kind of history. So they used words like the right of individual dignity or right to clean and healthful environment. Neither of these had any judicial or other background to explain them.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, the work I've done in the U.S. Constitution is basically, was a lot of different things I've worked on, but the largest body of work I've done is clarifying for people what these, what provisions in the U.S. Constitution meant when they were adopted. Explaining that the necessary and proper clause, for example, isn't vague at all. Some people assume it has a specific meaning. So that much of the work I've done is explaining the Founders' Constitution to modern Americans, and that's usually where this, where I get cited by the Supreme Court or by federal courts. Some of the state courts have cited my constitutional work, but they've also cited other areas I've worked in, like real estate.
Rob Nadelson again with us, a special guest here today. And to your point, the U.S. Constitution, again, thanks AI, 4,500 words. Montana's is over 40,000 words. And I think that does is another example of your point there. How do we, if the Constitution changes, how does that change laws that were previously decided upon that Constitution?
I'm sorry, Tom, I didn't understand your question.
It's if we rewrite the Constitution, right? And yeah, there are lots of laws that have been determined by an old Constitution. What happens to those laws under a new Constitution?
That's a very good question. I would not anticipate the convention doing a totally changing the Constitution.
Yeah.
I would anticipate the convention making clarifications, putting a few additional provisions in. So if a new Constitution is adopted, then there'll be much of it that will be the same as the old Constitution. You mentioned the preamble, for example. In my view, the current Montana Constitution's preamble is beautiful and should be preserved unless you can convince me to the contrary. And there are other parts of the current Constitution I think are fine. So you're going to have continuity there. There will, on the other hand, be changes. And those changes sometimes could impact laws. If a law which was valid under the old Constitution becomes invalid under the new Constitution, then that law is invalid because, after all, the people adopt the new Constitution and their will is supreme. But even in the change between the 1889 and 1972 Constitution, there were many provisions that were similar, and there were a lot of cases and rules that simply could continue.
Is there an example of where a state has rewritten, I guess Montana, 1972, where that process can be refined?
Oh, yeah. I mean, you often hear people who are praising the Montana Constitution, saying that this is a unique event, you know, nothing ever happened like it before. That's a bunch of horse feathers. The Montana Constitution revision is not unique at all. There was a big push in the 1960s and early 1970s by liberal and progressive forces in the country, supported by federal funds, by the way, to get states to write their constitutions or rewrite them to give more power to government. And there were something like 10 different constitutional conventions held between 1965 and 1975, just in that 10-year period. And six states revised their constitutions. I don't know if I remember them all, but one of them was Louisiana. Another was Illinois. There were several others as well. And then there was an unsuccessful effort in Texas to revise the Constitution. So this has been done a great deal. I mean, we know how this procedure works. We know what the rules are.
Boy, we talk about the importance of our Constitution and you know, tightening up the language regarding it as well. There is a ruling that came out, again, from some of the courts along the West Coast. It has to do with water and salmon and the recovery. That's going to actually pull back a lot of power out of the Northwest through a legal ruling. We'll have more on that as with Montana Electric Cooperatives Association. Mark Lambrick will join us tomorrow as well. Then I mentioned Bob Morris, so we'll come alongside as well. A lot of energy questions about potential data centers, and he's got a lot of answers as Lance Energy Chair. Finishing up with our guest here, one of our favorites, Rob Nadelson, of course, original host of Voices of Montana, Senior Fellow in Constitutional Jurisprudence at the Independent Institute. A lot of great stuff, Rob. The outfits you work for, they just really pour out really good information. That's i2i.org. Mountain States Policy Center is mountainstatespolicy.org. And then more writings at nadelsonrob.com. Started that blog here. Rob, thanks again for being here. I mean, we only got like about now 3 minutes, and I wanted to ask about your family, because when you sent out a note informing folks that you were cited again in that recent ruling, 41st time, the first thing you mentioned, though, was that you had a spelling bee champion in the family.
Oh, yeah. That was more important.
Yeah. That's good.
People in Western Montana may remember years ago when I hosted the show, I would sometimes bring my young daughter on. Her name is Rebecca. She has two daughters of her own now, as well as a newborn baby, or actually about a year old. And the oldest daughter, Charlotte, just won her school-wide spelling bee for the second year in a row. So naturally, I had to trumpet that above the Supreme Court citation.
Yeah.
Also, Tom, I know you wanted to ask me about my next trip to Montana.
Yes, yeah, when?
I will be speaking in Missoula on March 20, 20th day of this month, to the Pachyderm Club at noon. I don't recall off the top of my head the venue, but it's very easy to find. So Pachyderm Club on the 20th. Then on the 22nd, I'll be the primary speaker at the Lewis and Clark County Lincoln Day Dinner.
Oh.
Obviously a dinner, it's in the evening. And for both of those, Rebecca and her family, Charlotte and Elise and Nathaniel and her husband James, are all going to join me. So so if you want to come hear me speak, that's great. But if you really want to meet the important people of the family, this is a great opportunity.
That's very cool, Rob. I appreciate that. Did you get out and do some hiking? I know it was a pretty mild winter there in Colorado.
It was. And I've done a certain amount of hiking. I've also done a certain amount of skiing on our miserable ski conditions. But I just love getting in the outdoors, and it keeps me fresh.
So the 20th in Missoula, the 22nd in Helena, Lewis and Clark County, Lincoln Reagan Day Dinner. Rob,
that's right.
Thank you so much for coming on. I appreciate that. I don't have enough time to get into anything deep. Thanks for sharing a bunch of that. And I hope you're well, sir, and I know it's a long haul between now and 2030, but the information is great for us. So I encourage you folks to hit those websites one more time. Rob, thank you so much.
Thank you, Tom. Bye-bye.
Yep. Rob Nadelson, it's nadelsonrob.com, mountainstatespolicy.org for the Mountain States Policy Center, and also the Independent Institute, i2i.org. Great stuff. Thanks for joining us for the podcast, and join us weekdays live from 9 a.m. to 10 a.m. for more Voices of Montana on great radio stations all across our Treasure State.